the more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying our habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Thank you for tuning into Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland. Voices for the Animals brings you a monthly program that gives a voice to the urgent animal welfare and animal rights issues happening locally, regionally, and worldwide. My name is Julianne Schwartz, and today we will be having an interview with Anita Krines. Anita is one of the co-founders of the SAVE Movement. The SAVE Movement now has 660 chapters worldwide. Most recently, the SAVE Movement has expanded their mission to include climate change and human health by creating Climate SAVE and Health SAVE. But before we get into our interview, I wanted to briefly talk about a couple of news items in regards to animal rights. Legislation has now passed the sale of new fur in California. This ban will go into effect in 2020. California is the first state to ban the sale of new fur, and this comes after several cities first banned the sale of fur locally. Here in Portland, we just had our second official animal rights march on Saturday, October 12th. Approximately 500 people took to the streets to demand justice and rights for non-human animals. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Anita Krines, who has been fighting for animal rights for many years. Hi, Anita, are you there?
Hi.
Hi, Anita, for being on the radio with us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, for the listeners that don't know what the SAVE Movement is, would you mind telling us a little bit of the origin story?
Yeah, so I moved into this area with a slaughterhouse in downtown Toronto. I lived within a kilometer of it, and I knew it was there, but I didn't do anything for 4 years. And then I adopted a dog, Mr. Bean, and we would walk on Lakeshore every morning, and that was the first time I saw pigs looking out of the portholes at me. And that was in 2010, and we started Toronto Pig Safe. And it started with two basic strategies. One is bearing witness, which means when you see an animal suffering, you don't look away, but you come as close as you can and try to help. And that's paraphrasing something Leo Tolstoy said, the great Russian writer. And the second strategy is love-based community organizing. You try to get as many people as you can to bear witness, and you use a love-based approach. Weekly vigils, and they are very inclusive. Like we have mothers, we have children, we have people in the neighborhood, people traveling from afar to bear witness to the animals. The type of bearing witness that we do is usually partial. It's not complete, because if it was fully bearing witness, we would be helping the animals in the way they want to be helped, rescued. We only rescue a few hundred animals each year worldwide, but what we usually do is just document and try to get more people to bear witness on the ground, and we also share what we see on social media and try to convert other people to veganism and activism.
Now, you mentioned a love-based movement. What does that mean in terms of activism, or just in general? What would you define love-based activism as?
Yeah, so I mean, you could have an approach where you see the other side as the enemy, as someone to defeat and overcome, or you could see the other side as an opponent. So we draw on the philosophies of Tolstoy and Gandhi did not use the word enemy; he used opponent. And when you see the other side that way, your goal is to transform them and convert them, and so that's very much our approach. It's we want to change the system from one that exploits animals to a plant-based food system. We want everyone to be part of the solution. The problem is so humongous, and the only way we're going to solve the animal emergency and the climate emergency is if we, we all work together and under one big tent.
I totally agree with that. As far as the movement, it's grown so quickly to 660 chapters around the world. Have you seen it continue to grow? Do you think it's still going to keep growing? I know that there's now the Climate Save as well as the Health Save. What are you seeing now as far as growth rates and different ways of activism?
So I think when we first started, bearing witness was such a transformative experience. We felt that everyone should bear witness. You know, there's a difference between watching a video, which can be powerful and, you know, can convert you to veganism and activism, but it's different from actually being on site and witnessing egregious injustice right before you and seeing an animal, you know, a beautiful being who's frightened and about to be murdered. And it's just like it just increases your level of accountability and responsibility in spending more time and resources to fight the injustice. So we find that bearing witness makes fighting for animal rights and environmental justice a bigger priority in your life. So we really feel everyone needs to do it. So when we started, our goal was to have a vigil at every slaughterhouse. And, you know, unfortunately, there are millions of slaughterhouses around the world. In the United States alone, there are thousands. For example, in New York City, there's about 100 live markets. So, you know, our goal is to, you know, is to have that many vigils. And that's just the slaughterhouses. We also want to have vigils at auctions and you know, factory farms down the road. So until these places are closed. So there's a lot, you know, we're just beginning. It sounds like we have a lot of groups, but in fact, we don't. If you look at the anti-slavery movement in the 1830s, there were Quakers that would walk town to town, and in Ohio alone, they had 400 anti-slavery societies in the state of Ohio. So that gives you some perspective in terms of how much work we need to do. So our goal is to keep on growing, like trying. We send people on organizing tours in other countries, and that's partly how we've expanded to having almost 700 animal safe chapters in 70 countries. When you look at the other chapters, the climate and health save, then we have almost 1,000 chapters.
Oh, 1,000 chapters with the other save groups.
Yeah,
that's incredible. And I can understand when you're saying from a perspective, 660 doesn't, it seems like a lot, but it's not as much as we could be doing. Hopefully we can get more people out there and doing that sort of activism.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, one strategy might be trying to get more people at one location, like just say, like I'm in Toronto. So thousands of people have bore witness in Toronto, but how do we get more people? You know, and, you know, every week there are new people coming to our vigils. We have three vigils a week. We have, once a week, we have vigils for cows, slaughterhouses in the northwest part of Toronto, and once a week it's for chickens, and then once a week for pigs. The pig slaughterhouse where we originally started our vigils went bankrupt, so now we go to Burlington, which is about half an hour out of Toronto, and we do vigils there, and they kill 10,000 pigs a day. And you know, one of the challenges we're always thinking about, how do you get more people to bear witness? And so we've developed some techniques, like the first technique we did was stage frequent direct action. So we did we promised the pigs we first bore witness to hold a minimum of three vigils a week, and we've by and large kept that promise all these years. And but then, you know, that's a good way to sort of, if you have these regular vigils, these weekly vigils, it makes it easy for people to join. You know, they might not join right away, and they'll think, oh, bearing witness is hard, but, you know, if you keep on doing them every week, you know, 6 months later, they might join you. And it's very easy to join because these actions are happening all the time. But then we developed some other techniques, so we started doing occasional all-day vigils, like 24-hour vigils and 30-hour vigils in Toronto, and inviting special guests, like lawyers, and to talk about legal rights, or someone who, like a nutritionist, or a celebrity. We also started doing like other things, like having a fast and so forth. Globally, other groups innovated. Like in Manchester, they started doing 5-day vigils. And then that sort of spread around the world. And then we did our first five-day vigil in Toronto this summer. In Barcelona, they did a, last year they did a five-day vigil and hunger strike. And then they did, and then we did that this year in Toronto. So we're always looking for ways to innovate. In L.A., a lot of celebrities go to the vigils, and they have weekly vigils at Farmer John's in downtown L.A., and their attendance is fairly high. They have about 150 people that come every week. And there's a second group, Animal Alliance Network, that does vigils on an alternative day in L.A., and they also get a high attendance. So, you know, holding frequent vigils really helps with attendance, but then also using other techniques. And we're always trying to innovate, like how do you get, you know, more people to bear witness? And I sometimes social media influencers like Joey Carbstrong or James Aspie have gone on have gone on tours and that really and gone to different slaughterhouses and that really helped bring up the numbers. I think that happened in Portland as well. Like I think there was a vigil with I think it was James Aspie and that sort of increased attendance a lot.
Since we're discussing bringing more people to the vigils, where do you think that the SAVE movement will go from here as far as the animal SAVE? Do you think it's going to go beyond holding vigils?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we basically started as a one-tactic group, you know, just doing vigil after vigil after vigil and really believing in the power of bearing witness. But we you know, after learning just from other movements like Extinction Rebellion, which uses escalating tactics and has a campaign focus, we've started adapting what we're doing. So thinking not in terms of just one tactic, but thinking in terms of campaigns. And so, for example, in Toronto, there's a slaughterhouse owned by Maple Leaf Foods. It's one of the biggest food companies in Canada. And they have the chicken slaughterhouse where we do our vigils. And for years, all we did was vigil after vigil after vigil. And then they decided to close three chicken slaughterhouses in Toronto and and southern Ontario, and open one mega slaughterhouse in London, Ontario, which is about 2 hours away from Toronto. And at that point, we started developing a campaign to try to stop them from building a new slaughterhouse, which would kill like 500,000 chickens a day and be one of the biggest slaughterhouses in the world. And so we started using new tactics. So we disrupted their shareholders meeting, and one of our members actually was able to interrupt the speech of the CEO and speak. And he was live streaming and sort of speaking for 10 minutes about the rights of chickens. And then we started doing home demonstrations at the CEO's home. And then the executives of the company called us, and we had a meeting with them. And we also have a second meeting with them. And this company is beginning to transition to plant-based. So they bought Field Roast and Light Life a couple years ago. So they're also investing in a new plant-based production facilities in Illinois. But at the same time, they're investing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in building this new slaughterhouse. So we have an ongoing campaign trying to convince them to not do that because of the, you know, animal emergency and just like killing, you know 500,000 you know, sentient beings each day, and also because of the climate emergency, it makes absolutely no sense to build slaughterhouses in this day and age where we should be switching, you know, to a plant-based food system right away.
With all the slaughterhouses closing down and transitioning into plant-based items, do you think a lot of that comes from everything that we're hearing about climate change, and the predictions are quite dire in terms of how long we have to make a very drastic change to prevent the global climate catastrophes? Do you think that there's hope that we can turn things around? Do you think that these places will still continue to shut down and change their ways?
I think that a lot of things are coming together. I mean, this year, it was a big year for Beyond Meat, and it's incredible to see like all the the restaurant chains and that are adopting plant-based burgers, and all the ads we're seeing, it's quite phenomenal. It's like I wouldn't have believed it if you told me that, there would be billboards advertising Light Life burgers, advertising Beyond Meat, all the ads that we're seeing in our city and even small towns in Ontario. And in London, Ontario, the place where they want to build that big chicken slaughterhouse, McDonald's is testing the Beyond Meat PLT right now until the end of the year. And if the test goes well, they'll be providing the Beyond Meat burger PLT across restaurants in North America. So, things are definitely changing. And so I think it's really important for us to have a clear vision, and when there are proposals to create new slaughterhouses, we need to have campaigns to stop them. Because unfortunately, there are still proposals like that, like in London, Ontario. Also, in north of Barcelona, they just recently constructed the biggest pig slaughterhouse. So like these places are still being proposed and built. And when you look at global figures, unfortunately, insanely, the number of animals killed each year is going up, even though that we have these other counter trends, for more plant-based. So we do have we have a big battle, big battles before us. It makes absolutely no sense to open new slaughterhouses, in fact, when we should be closing them and just fully switching to plant-based. So if you look at the global numbers, it's still, we have a lot of work to do.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Voices for Animals, and we're speaking with Anita Krines today. Anita, we were just talking about climate change. I want to veer off just a little bit into information about your new documentary that you're in works about the SAVE movement.
So, yes, we're working on a documentary called Bear Witness, which would explore the ideas behind bearing witness, including the philosophy of it, and explore the ideas of love and nonviolence that Tolstoy and Gandhi spoke about. So what we want to do is show the growth of the SAVE movement, but we also want to present ideas that are the foundations of the movement. So Leo Tolstoy, he was a great realist writer, born in 1828, and he died in 1910. And towards the latter part of his life, the last three decades, he became an ethical vegetarian. And he was one of the leading publishers of animal rights books and vegetarian cookbooks in Russia. He set up a publishing firm. And he really liked the work of Henry Salt, also another book by Howells called The Ethics of Diet. And so he, which was about famous vegetarians over the last couple thousand years. And so he was writing the introduction to it. And he wrote this introductory essay called The First Step. And he was this great realist writer who would do a lot of research before he wrote. So when he wrote War and Peace, he would go to the battlefields where Napoleon had invaded, and in order to write the scenes. And so writing this introductory essay, he felt that he had to bear witness at a slaughterhouse. So he went to this town, Tula, which was by train from where he lived. He lived near Moscow. And he went to the slaughterhouse and witnessed bulls and lambs and pigs being slaughtered. And he went right to the kill floor, and he described what he saw in great detail. And what's surprising is what he described is still happening to this day. So he described how at that time they didn't have electric prods, but the workers would twist the tails of the bulls to push them forward. And there would be crackling sounds, like, so they were basically torturing them that way, and the bull would always back up, and then they would twist their tails again and sort of push them into the kill floor. And a worker would hit them over the head. And today, you know, there might be stun guns or there might not be. But the animal is still conscious. So, the animal would fall to the ground and they would begin, skinning the animal while the animal's conscious. And that happens to this day. Conscious animals are skinned. And they would start dismembering the animal and the animal would be flailing. And anyways, he described, how the workers were, smoking casually and talking and just being completely oblivious to the suffering animals. And it became a classic document. It became almost like the Bible of the animal rights movement. So he bore witness in 1891 at a slaughterhouse. And in Britain, there was the Humane League that presented investigative accounts of Smithfield Market and the suffering of the animals there. And interesting enough, these past 2 weeks, there's been an animal rebellion in London, and Smithfield Market was one of the targets where they where 400 people camped out and also presented an alternative fruit and vegetable market there.
And the documentary is going to be about those things that you are seeing when you are at vigils.
It's about the bearing witness documentary will show how activists around the world are bearing witness, and the different animals, and also how we're using organizing tours to grow, as well as show the importance of the climate catastrophe and how we need to switch to a plant-based system so that we can stop destroying forests. Because currently, the deforestation rates continue to happen. Like, there are less and less forests every year because of animal agriculture. So the Amazon was on fire this summer because it was set on fire by the agribusiness interests who want to expand cattle ranching and to grow soy, GMO soy, for animal feed. To be exported to Europe and China. So this insanity, associated with animal agriculture, needs to stop. We need to switch to a plant-based system and stop deforesting the earth and using up the freed up land to plant trees and reforest the earth and take carbon out of the atmosphere. Because currently we are, I think it's about 415 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. And, there's an organization called 350.org, and the idea was, if we get over 350.org, we're in real trouble. But every year, we keep on going 1 to 2 parts per million up. So it's like we are heading towards runaway climate change and crossing tipping points. And the only way we can stop this is not only phase out fossil fuels, but also end the animal agriculture industry and reforest the earth, so that we can take carbon out of the atmosphere and go back down to below 250, to go back down to, pre-industrial levels of carbon in the atmosphere, which was about 270 parts or 280 parts per million.
When and where can people look forward to finding this documentary that you're going to be releasing?
So it'll probably be out sometime next year, and we're currently working on it. I'm working with a writer in L.A., Brittany Michelson, who's also a DXC organizer in L.A.,
Last month, there was a few rallies for climate change. You were able to meet with Greta, correct? For the listeners who don't know who Greta is, she's a 16-year-old girl who's fighting for climate change named Greta Thunberg.
Yes. Greta Thunberg is, I think, in my view, she's the most important person on the planet right now. I think she's an incredible voice for truth and what needs to happen in terms of addressing climate catastrophe. She started these student strikes in September. She was going on strike every day before the election in Sweden to try to force the politicians to take climate chaos seriously. And then she decided to continue the strikes and do them on Fridays. So her group is called Fridays for Future, and it spread worldwide. And they, besides doing these every Friday striking, doing school strikes, they also do global actions. So recently they had the third global strike, and she came to Montreal, Canada, and there were like 500,000 people that were on the streets to hear her. So, and worldwide it was like 6 million people. And then the fourth global strike will be at the end of November. And she's vegan, and she says she's vegan for ethical and for both climate and environmental reasons as well. And she's an incredible inspiration. She was on the cover of Time, and she also doesn't fly. So when she came to North America, she went on a sailboat, and she named the sailboat Unite Behind the Science. So her point is, we need to listen to the science. We need to listen to the IPCC. So the IPCC is this international body that reviews or assesses the peer-reviewed articles on the science, the impacts, and the response strategies to climate change. And she is only 16, and she reads these reports, you know, something adults don't do. So she reads these scientific reports and says, you know, we need, there's this climate emergency and we have to act on it. And she talks about the carbon budget. She says that, you know, the IPCC last year, IPCC stands for Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, last year came out with a report that said the climate budget was only something like 600 gigatons of carbon if we're not to go over the 1.5 degrees Celsius increase in temperature. And if we do, like if we go past that, we're going to cross many tipping points. And she said, we've already used so much of our budget that in 8.5 years, it'll all be gone.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Anita. This has been Julianne Schwartz with Voices for the Animals interviewing Anita Kreins, co-founder of the SAVE movement. Anita and I are going to continue this conversation. To listen, check out kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals, where you will find the extended podcast version of this episode. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Instagram at Voices for the Animals. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Tune in every fourth Friday of the month at 10 a.m. to hear Voices for the Animals. Bye-bye. Thank you. I get tongue-tied when I'm nervous.
Oh, no. Well, it didn't show.
Well, I appreciate that. So now we're moving on to the podcast version, which is a little bit more loose, and I should be a little less nervous with that. Noah's here laughing.
Hi, Anita.
Laughing at
Noah,
me.
Noah Bristol, co-host and current board op for today. Yeah, it's been lovely listening to you. You're a very inspiring figure. And yeah, welcome to the podcast version of the show. We only have about 28 and a half minutes on the air, so for especially interesting guests like yourself, we like to have a little bit more time and just allow our listeners who are most interested to go online and hear more from you.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Yeah, and I had a few questions that came up as I was listening, because your story, I mean, it's the dream for a lot of activists to, you know, start something just out of the goodness of your heart and what you did, just going and giving some compassion and some water to pigs who'd probably never experienced love, at least from humans in their lives, and then for that to become a global movement. And I'm curious if it started as simply as that, or you had in mind that you wanted to make this a movement from the very beginning.
I think we wanted to make it a movement right away, because when you bear witness and you look in the face of a pig that's an individual and they're pleading for their life, you know that everyone should see this, because if everyone saw it, this evil that they're subjected to would stop. Like it's. I think the reason these things are happening is there's this disconnect. And I already was a vegan. I was already an activist, but it wasn't a big priority in my life. Only when I bore witness and I saw the victim, the pigs before me, did I make it, you know, number one priority in my life.
Absolutely.
And if people knew how bad it was, how bad it is for animals, the animals that they love, like people love animals. They bring more joy to people's lives than anything. I think if people knew, they would just drop things and just focus on just stopping this injustice. And you know, what's really odd or ironic is that the way we treat animals is going to ultimately come back at us, and sort of we're going to end our life the way we end other animals' lives. You know, we're polluting the atmosphere with carbon dioxide. We send pigs to slaughterhouses with, you know, carbon dioxide poison.
Mm-hmm.
To stun them. You know, I just find it so ironic.
Yeah, that's a powerful idea, that the destruction we bring unto others is what will come back upon us eventually.
Yeah.
And maybe sooner than we all think, if the predictions that the scientists are telling us about the climate change crisis come to pass, which, of course, is more than likely.
Yeah. And, you know, Tolstoy said, when we wish to harm others, we really do evil to ourselves, you know.
Hmm.
Or, you know, and then I think that's one that it's all, you know, the ultimate consequence could be our extinction. You know, which is it's really frightful when you start learning more about climate chaos. And I think Greta is doing an incredible job in terms of asking us to unite behind the science and just to follow what the scientists are saying at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And you know, Stephen Hawking, before he died, he said if Trump continues with his policies, you know, denying climate chaos and the greenhouse effect, that it will be raining sulfuric acid. And, you know, that's what's happening on Venus. Like, if you have a runaway climate change, you could eventually have that happen here.
And I imagine that's what helped inspire the change to also incorporating climate save and health save in the save movement, right?
Exactly. So, we, you know, Toronto Pig Save originally had a climate vegan campaign three, four years ago. So I had nightmares years ago. Like for a week or two, I couldn't even get out of bed. I was so depressed about climate chaos. I have a PhD in political science, and my two case studies were climate change and old growth rainforests in British Columbia. So I have some background in sort of studying the formation of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and 1988 and its development, and but I didn't think about it for a while, and then I returned to it like a few years ago, and I just thought, oh my God, like this could be the end of the planet. And when we started the climate vegan campaign, we had teach-ins in Toronto. We had 250 ads on the subway saying, "Are we eating the planet to death?" and, you know, promoting cowspiracy on the subway and things like that. But it had no traction. Like, it was like, there just wasn't any public interest. Then, late last year, we started these two new branches, Climate Save and Animal Save. Now there's so much interest in Climate Save. I believe it's going to be a much bigger branch of the Save movement than the Animal Save.
Interesting. And what do you think that those groups are doing differently that is polarizing to the public and gaining attention?
I think the times have changed. Like, people are like, thank goodness, like it all happened very recently. It's like Greta started the Fridays for Future last September, last year.
Amazing, then, what can happen in a year.
Yeah, and then Extinction Rebellion also launched a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two most exciting groups. Before that, we just had groups like 350.org, which completely denies the role of like animal agriculture. Maybe they're going to change now. That's Bill McKibben's group.
Mm-hmm.
And we had Greenpeace and all these other groups. So none of these groups really emphasized animal agriculture or the full picture or the extent of the emergency. So thank goodness for like Greta's Fridays for Future. She's vegan. And also Extinction Rebellion, one of the co-founders, Roger Hallam, is vegan as well.
Mm-hmm.
He's a organic farmer. And he's a brilliant strategist. So I think that's what's changed. Like, we have these new groups that are led by youth or just exciting groups that understand the role of civil disobedience, like Extinction Rebellion. So I think that's what's changed. Like, we have these two incredible groups and climate, and there's another offshoot, Animal Rebellion, that also joined the Extinction Rebellion these past 2 weeks in London.
Yeah, do you know much about what's been happening in London? Can you describe it for our audience?
So every half year, Extinction Rebellion is organizing 2 weeks of rebellion. So their first 2 weeks of rebellion were in April of this year, and 1,100 people were arrested, and they blocked like five major areas in London. So this October was the second major rebellion. The Conservative government in England declared a climate emergency. So Extinction Rebellion said, well, okay, they've declared a climate emergency, but they're not implementing policy. So that's why they did this next rebellion in October for 2 weeks. And a new group formed called Animal Rebellion, and it's the result of the animal think tank. And they're basically following the same strategy, the same theory of change, the same escalating tactics of extinction. So Extinction Rebellion, once again, you know, blocked various like intersections and key locations, like in front of the parliament and so forth. And
yeah, tactics including making trouble, basically, to get attention and get things done.
Like disrupting, like mass disruptions in the city center, so it affects people's lives. So they, I spoke to Roger Hallam half a year ago, and he was saying, he was critiquing the animal rights movement, saying, you know, DXC, Save, AV, like, you know, great work, but it's you're just doing movement building. You're not disrupting society on a mass scale. So what Extinction Rebellion does, it goes to the capital city, and it disrupts the city center, so it affects hundreds of thousands, millions of people. So everybody, when Extinction Rebellion started doing its actions, everybody in the country knew about it.
And that's how the UK became, as far as I know, the first country in the world to formally recognize the climate emergency, right?
Yeah, it's certainly among the first. Like, I'm not sure exactly, but yeah, certainly, you know, was definitely a leader.
Powerful.
And but the next step now is like to implement changes, and so that's why they're continuing the rebellion. And so the Animal Rebellion joined, and they're doing a lot of exciting action, like occupying the Smithfield Market. They also went to the fish market in London. I think yesterday they went to a slaughterhouse near London and locked on, stopped the killing facility from operating. And they're always doing like very creative actions. They had a pea leaf, like peas as in P-E-A-S, leaf liaison, and it's a very funny video that came out of that. So they're doing incredible work.
Well, going back to vigils, it's, you know, a unique form of action that for a long time as an activist, I never considered it, and I never heard of a vigil until just maybe 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago. And many people in this movement find great inspiration from it because you get to actually see the animals that you're working so hard to defend. And it can be hard and difficult emotionally, and sometimes for some people in my experience, it can't be something they do all the time or it's just too difficult for them. But that difficulty in looking those beings in the eyes and seeing, yes, this is this being's last day on Earth, it's inspiring, and it keeps a lot of us motivated to keep on going. And I know that Julianne has a story like that. I think that the Animal Save movement was the first form of animal activism that she ever experienced and joined. Would you like to tell us about that?
Yes, I'm actually from California, Anita. I've been to the vigils at Farmer John's quite a few times. I have been vegan for a year, and in that same amount of time, I've been an activist. I was living in Chino, California, and one day I was driving my friend home from work and looked over to the side of the road and saw a bunch of people holding signs saying 2 minutes with the cows and stop eating meat, things of that sort. And I pulled over and I spoke with one of the activists, AJ, who is still a very good friend of mine, who I look up to very much. And he explained to me that we were in front of a slaughterhouse and, you know, pointed out the body parts coming out of the building, etc. And from that day forward, I decided I'm not going back. I don't want to see that. And it took me another year to get back to that. And from then on, I started going to vigils twice a week, you know, one in Chino, California, and the other one at Farmer John's. And it just really changed my life completely, going vegan and associating with the animals, with what people are eating, because you can actually see the pain and hurt that's being caused by humans just to have food, what they consider food. And it's just, it's not right. And there's not enough that I could possibly say about the importance of vigils, because I know how I've changed from it, and just how I can share that with other people in my life. I can show them those videos that I'm taking personally, and they can connect with those sort of visuals.
Yeah, that's really great. Great to hear. Yeah, you see, when you hear stories like that, I just think, like, boy, I wish more people could do that. You know what I mean? I think the world would change faster, because it changes your life completely. Like, your life before and after vigils is different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we're, as animal lovers, as humans who love life, you know, who love, you know, respect life, who want, you know, want to create a beautiful life for all beings, and we can't be happy ourselves unless others are happy and are not oppressed. And this is happening in our communities, and before vigils, like people go about their business thinking they're, you know, progressive and doing, you know, trying to make the world a better place, but they're oblivious to, like, these killing facilities right in their community and or near their community. And I just think, like, it's so important to be aware, to be awake, you know, and to witness what these animals are going through, because it's they're innocent beings, and they bear witness their entire life. They are exploited, abused. They're separated from their mothers. They're separated from their friends. They have no control over their lives, and their families, and, you know, they're not able to play. They're not able to eat healthy food. They're not able to engage in any natural behaviors. They're confined. They're imprisoned. They're tortured, and then they're ultimately murdered. And it's just like, I just think, I know for myself, my life completely changed once I started bearing witness. And I do believe that people need to do it again and again, even if it's painful, because it is. It's traumatic, but people can easily forget. And also, it's important to do it again and again so you can bring others on board. And I think one of our biggest challenges is, how do we invite others to do it? Because it is life transformative.
I know from personal experience how easy it is to just go through our lives with blinders on, even though there's a facility in your neighborhood or a couple of miles away or in your city where tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of innocent animals are killed or being abused or being neglected every day or every year. And we can just go on about our lives without thinking about it until something happens to wake us up. And I think about that pretty frequently. Just here in the Portland area, there's the OHSU, Oregon Health Sciences University, has a primate research center where over 5,000 primates are held, imprisoned, and experimented on. And yeah, every time I go to that part of town, I try to think about that and be conscious of it, because it's when we have those blinders on that abuse is allowed to thrive.
I wish there could be, like, a primate safe group starting there that could do vigils, like weekly mm-hmm. vigils, and just, you know, be there. Like, I know there are, like, in Australia, we have some, there's SAIL groups, Save Animals in Laboratories, like SAIL,
mm-hmm.
Melbourne or something, Melbourne SAIL or something. So we have a few animal and laboratory groups that, you know, I'm hoping maybe somebody could start doing vigils who goes to that university or lives nearby. Because when I started doing 3 vigils a week, every week, like even during the holidays, every single week of the year, we did 3 vigils. I lived like 2-3 minutes walk from the intersection where we did most of the vigils. So it was very easy for me to do it. And I think that is important. So I think it's very important to engage in, like, community organizing and getting the local community involved. Because if you live far away, it's easier to say, well, you know, I can't do it, or I can do it once a month or once a, you know, whatever it is. But if you live nearby, I think it's very important to, like, mobilize people in your community to do regular and frequent mm-hmm. vigils, because I think that's what can change things faster. And also to think in terms of campaigns. So don't just think about one tactic, same tactic over and over, but think in terms of escalating campaigns. You know, it might be a home demonstration. It might be a shareholders disruption. It might be targeting the banks that, you know, fund these entities.
Absolutely. Well, if you ever doubt that vigils do make a difference, you can remember Julianne's story. And all it took was driving past a vigil to plant a seed that turned her into a dedicated animal rights activist.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, it's a great story. Thanks, Julianne.
Well, thank you. I mean, I have you to thank for it. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of other people involved and obviously the animals. But I was so excited that you wanted to be on the show just to talk with you, because it's just incredible that, you know, you started this movement. It's got 660 chapters. That's just incredible to think about. And, you know, when we have like the Animal Liberation Conference and other things that we go to, you know, we are bearing witness and we're standing out in front of slaughterhouses and people are going inside of slaughterhouses and rescuing animals. And, you know, it all started with you giving water to pigs, you know, years ago.
Well, yeah, it sort of started like with my dog, because I really think, like, if I never adopted Mr. Bean, it wouldn't have happened, because I lived near the slaughterhouse for 4 years and I was a vegan and activist and I did nothing. It never even occurred to me to go to the slaughterhouse and look at the animals. Nothing. Like, I just thought about it a few minutes when I was on a streetcar and I could see the chimney in a distance and I thought, oh, somebody should do something. And then I adopted Mr. Bean, and then walking slowly and seeing the trucks in rush hour traffic and for the first time seeing the pigs look out of the trucks, that's how it started. And the only reason it grew as a worldwide movement is because we had a team leadership philosophy, expanding team leadership. I had taught in university a course on social movement strategies and tactics and was inspired by Marshall Gantz, who was a director of operations for the United Farm Workers. And the reason that that group was very successful is they had expanding team leadership. And so we learned from other movements. And so we used love-based community organizing. The idea that everyone is a leader, everyone's a can be a community organizer. So when you think of the SAVE movement, how it evolved, there's many, many founders. Everybody, when we brought new people on the team, they improved our tactics. You know, some people were better at love-based activism than the rest of us, and then we learned from them. So it's very much the SAVE movement is what it is because of just all the local leadership around the world innovating. And, you know, the LA vigils are among the biggest. Amy Jean Davis is one of the lead organizers, and she has dinners before or after each vigil, and she says that's one of the reasons the vigils are so big, because there's a lot of community building. So we're always trying to learn from each other. And so, you know, your story is very inspiring, and I'm sure you'll be able to recruit others based on what you've done.
It takes many people of many different strengths to create a movement and to create a community of people who are consistent in activism, because it is very easy to get burned out, you know, seeing all of this suffering that is happening in the world and fighting against it and perhaps feeling powerless to create real change unless you have that community around you.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Like, the only, the best answer to, you know, burnout is community and love and, you know, supporting each other. And absolutely. And so we should spend a lot of time just thinking about that, you know, being the change and the processes that we use. So we're building community as we're also, you know, winning our campaigns.
Well, I have a two-part question for you, which is for both people who are listening who are not activists, are not involved in animal rights, what do you think is most important for them to know that we haven't covered yet? And then the same question for people who are activists.
For people who aren't activists, I there was a time when I wasn't an activist and I actually thought, oh, being activist was like weird or something. Or it was frightening. It was like frightening to challenge authority, things like that. But after I became an activist, I feel I'm alive, I'm awake, I feel my life is much, much more meaningful. And I think it's important to know the truth. I think you can't go through life, living in a bubble, not living in your comfort zone, not fighting for justice. Like, I don't think anyone can be happy when, you know, there's injustice elsewhere, when, you know, the animals that we love are imprisoned, where there's climate chaos, where there's social injustice. So I think, you know, if you want to lead a meaningful life, it's really important to be an activist. And then for activists, what was your question about activists?
Oh, just anything that you think that they should know or hear from you and all your experience that we haven't covered yet.
Okay, so we've learned a lot about how to do things maybe differently. So we started Toronto Pig Save in 2010, and basically it was a one-tactic organization. And then after learning more about Extinction Rebellion, we were inspired by how fast they grew to be much bigger than all the animal rights global groups put together. Like they, mm-hmm. within a year, they were just like massive. And so they've all the leadership and the members, they study a book called This is an Uprising. And there's a webinar series that accompanies this book. You can watch it free on Aini Institute YouTube. It's AYNI, Aini Institute YouTube channel. They have a series called Momentum Organizing. And it's an 8-part webinar series. It's an hour and a half each webinar. And then the book, again, is This is an Uprising. And the book is about this type of organizing that takes the best of the two major traditions. So there's the Saul Alinsky community organizing approach, which you have incremental goals and shows how you can win, small campaigns. Like, say you want lower tuition fees or something like that. Then there's this other organizing model called mass protests, and it's like, you know, the Occupy Wall Street and protests like that. And so it takes the best of those traditions and comes up with a hybrid model. And in this hybrid model, you do both those things. So Martin Luther King often did both those things in the civil rights movement. There would be, you know, just strong community organizing. So, for example, in Montgomery, there was the Montgomery Improvement Association, which had all these community groups, like women's groups, labor groups, church groups, and so forth. But then there would also be, like, mass protests, like in Birmingham, you know, mm-hmm. where 1,000 children went to jail. And there would be mass media of the mass protests. But there would also be strong organization. And then there would be things called, like, there would be trigger events, but also, like, moments of whirlwind where there's just
Absolutely.
So much mass media, so much interest that people start copying what you're doing because it's such a great idea. And so that happened with the sit-ins. Like, you started with the Nashville sit-ins, but then that model just spread it throughout the South. And Gandhi also had this type of hybrid organizing with, you know, the Salt March. So Extinction Rebellion is trying to replicate that. So they do those 2 weeks of rebellion, and they're on the front pages every day, and they're getting people to do civil disobedience. And so their goal is to get 3.5% of the population to do activism. So I don't know if you've heard of that figure before, but it's there have been some studies that show that revolutions or rebellions have been successful if 3.5% of the population is mobilized. In the United States, that would be, I don't know, something like 10 million people. So the idea is that you can actually achieve these big changes if you can mobilize that many people. But then there's a second thing you have to do. You also have to mobilize the majority of public opinion. Once you have those two things, you can have major change. Like, we could actually switch from, you know, animal agriculture system to plant-based food system.
So you only need the sympathy of the majority, but the yeah. active participation of a relatively small part
exactly.
of civilization.
Exactly. And, you know, doing the right thing. And that's very inspiring. So, like, the civil rights movement was able to mobilize a lot of people. You know, Gandhi was. And so Extinction Rebellion is trying to follow this model. And so what I'm saying is that, yes, we have this model that's important, like vigils, but we have to think in bigger terms. We have to think in terms of momentum organizing. We have to think in terms of joining Extinction Rebellion, like the Animal Rebellion. We have to think in terms of campaigns and escalating tactics. And I strongly recommend that activists read This is an Uprising.
This is an Uprising. And what was the name of that YouTube series?
It's called Momentum Organizing, and it's the YouTube channel is Amy Institute, A-Y-N-I.
I'm sure our listeners will check it out.
Yeah, I can send you a link if you want to put it on your page.
Well, Anita, I was interested to get your opinion on all these celebrities coming forward to promote veganism and plant-based, one including Joaquin Phoenix, who's huge right now. What do you think about all these celebrities, you know, promoting it? And do you think that that's going to change a lot of people's perspective on veganism instead of being, you know, feared it's like actually going to be accepted?
I think it's incredibly important. If you look at the civil rights movement, Harry Belafonte and Joan Baez and all the freedom singers were all important in terms of popularizing the movement. If you look at the United Farm Workers, they recruited a lot of celebrities. So we definitely need celebrities to speak up. Billie Eilish is promoting veganism. I think Joaquin Phoenix is absolutely wonderful. He's speaking more and more now about his veganism at a time when, you know, the Joker, the film is, you know, the number one film right now. And it's just like, I think he's doing tremendous work. So when he came to Toronto, to the Toronto International Film Festival, we invited him to do a photo op at the Be Fair, Be Vegan Subway campaign at St. George Subway. And he came, and we had like mass media coverage of it. So it was absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, and I think Jane Fonda is being arrested every Friday.
Wow, that's incredible.
I believe that's what I read. She's for climate change.
Yeah.
So that's pretty incredible.
Yeah. And Billie Eilish is like supporting Fridays for Future. Like, she just did an ad with Woody Harrelson for Greenpeace and Fridays for Future. So that's very exciting. And
it's an exciting time to be alive. I hope that we all keep to continue living on a green earth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think we need to be eco-vegans. Like, I don't think it's enough to be a vegan. I know a lot of people think, well, I'm a vegan, so, you know, I'm part of the solution, but it's not enough. I think, you know, I spoke to Sean Munson, who did Earthlings, and he's quite obsessed with climate chaos now. He's read, like, 10 books on it, and he and Amy Jean Davis just had a baby named Phoenix, after Joaquin Phoenix.
Oh.
And he said that we all need to be eco-vegans. Because veganism is only about 30% of the solution to climate chaos. The other 70% is fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
So the solution there is also can be very positive. Like, if we move to a soft energy path with solar energy and wind power and also conservation, you know, it could lead to a lot of jobs. There are many benefits moving away from fossil fuels.
Yeah, I think whoever we are in life, complacency is a real enemy. Whether you're a vegan or not, or whether you're, you know, using a metal straw instead of plastic straws, and you think, okay, I'm a good person now, I got it locked down. Well, there's always more that can be done, and
exactly.
It's not just about our personal consumer habits, but also about how we interact with the world and how we fight as activists in whatever realm needs us.
Right. I think we have a responsibility acting morally on an individual level. Like, so for there needs to be individual change, like diet change and how we consume, but there also needs to be system change. So we also have to lobby corporations and governments to implement system change, because the crisis is one where we all need to participate in the solution. We face a climate emergency, we face an animal emergency, and a health crisis. And we, in order to address it, we have to treat it like World War II, where, you know, we need a big tent, and we all need to work together for the solution. I mean, we need to think in that type of way, where it's so urgent that we all need to work together. You know, we have to set aside our differences. It's not political. I think we have to just, all of us, you know, all parties, everyone has to work together on the solution.
Yeah, some things are that important, and the fate of our planet and our climate is certainly one of them.
Yeah.
Now, at the beginning of our episode, we talked about a news item about how California has recently become the first state in the U.S. to ban the sale of new fur items, and that's a piece of system change that is happening here. What's some more legislation that's in the works or that's recently been passed that you're most excited about?
That's incredibly exciting. I want to see legislation that would ban dairy and you know, animal flesh. So I'm just waiting to see when that happens. I know Switzerland recently had a campaign where they received more than 100,000 signatures on a petition, and that would to ban factory farming. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly an attempt there to start that process.
Their
legal system really relies on these kind of petitions.
I was discussing that very issue with a Swiss vegan the other night, and she was actually opposed to it because, in her perspective, the animals and the way that those operations are run in Switzerland, of course, it's not good, but it's better than a lot of other places. And she thinks that if it's banned there, people would simply import those products from other places where the animals are treated even worse. What do you think about that?
I think, like, banning factory farms is only one step, but what they could also do then is ban imports, mm-hmm. like, in order to address the concern that you brought up. So what we need are, you could have meat-free zones. You could, supermarkets could be, neighborhoods could become meat-free zones. I think that's going to happen soon.
Yeah, many aspects of system change in the past have seemed impossible, and that might be the reaction of some of our listeners now. Oh, that'll never happen. Those things will never be banned. But who knows?
I think it will. I think if once we receive 3.5% of active participation and majority support, these kind of horrendous facilities will be illegal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a time when we didn't have the UN Declaration on human rights. And then 1948, we got that declaration, and then we started getting the Convention against Torture and, Convention on Political and Civil Rights. So these things will happen. Like, it is illegal to summarily execute a human being, but it's not when it comes to an animal, like a pig or, another animal. Like, why not? There will be a time when that's going to be as illegal.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today, Anita. And I know I can speak for Julianne when I say that as well.
Yes,
well, thank you.
Likewise.
It was great. It was really inspiring to hear your stories, too. And, great questions. And thank you. It was really great talking to you.
Thank you for being on the show. We appreciate everything that you're doing and support you 100%.
Thank you so much. Likewise. Thank you.
All righty. Thank you, Anita.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Have a good night. Bye. We'll be right back.